Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, two great tastes that taste great together. Turns out that what's true for Reese's Peanut Butter Cups is also true for music and literature. Acclaimed singer-songwriter Jeffrey Dean Foster and award-winning author Ray Morrison are here to tell us just how. Then Greensboro College brings us back to the Bard, his 12th night, and what makes Shakespeare so great. St. Paul's Friends of Music series rolls on with one of the world's leading forte piano performing and recording artists. UNCG's Andrew Willis is here to share the loud and quiet side of the grandpappy to the king of the concert stage. Speaking of the king, Karoff is back at the keyboard with a look at the composer who picked up the forte piano baton from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven and ran with it right on through the Romantic period. It's Robert Schumann, up close and personal. And we'll wrap up today's program live in Studio A with the man who brought jazz to the concert hall, George Gershwin. Martha Bassett and the Carolina Chamber Symphony Players Jazz Trio is here to sing and play and swing next on Triad Arts Weekend. You know, it's rare that you get a chance to experience and learn about great songwriting plus great short story writing all in one great evening. But thanks to Press 53 and two great storytellers, you can enjoy just such an experience, plus beer, wine, and a delicious meal if you'd like, at the Community Arts Cafe in downtown Winston-Salem. Two great storytellers, one great evening is tonight, February 22nd at 7:30, 6:30 if you'd like dinner as well. North Carolina Arts Council Fellowship for Songwriting recipient Jeffrey Dean Foster has been releasing amazing songs since he and his first band were signed to Arista Records by Clive Davis back in the mid-80s. Jeffrey's currently working on a new soon-to-be-released album, and we'll be sampling from it next. Jeffrey's good friend Ray Morrison is an award-winning author. His debut collection of short stories, In a World of Small Truths, published by Press 53, was called Surprising with Subtlety and Strength by HBO's True Blood executive story editor and Showtime's Weeds co-producer Chris Offutt. You can hear Ray reading from his book, Jeffrey singing from his new album, and then chat with them both after the show.
Well, here's how it came about.
Okay.
It came about as a joke by Jeff.
Okay.
When just shortly before my collection was going to be published by Press 53, I was talking with Jeff, and he was all excited for me, and Jess simply joked and said, "You know what? We should do a two-man show. We should, you get out there and read your stories, and I'll sing a few songs." And we laughed and thought it was hilarious.
But I'll open for you. I'll open for you on your book tour, you know.
Yeah.
And that was it, you know.
But then I thought about it over a course of a couple of months. And then I thought, you know, Jeff's pretty popular. He's very talented. He's probably ride his coattails and sell a couple of books.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
So, how did you guys meet?
Well, we have a few different connections. As Ray is a Renaissance man. He's a well-known veterinarian in town. So he's doctored many of my dogs over the years. And I am, by trade, a house painter as well. And I've been under their employ many times. So, yeah, I've just been around their house a lot, you know. And
yeah.
I used to see get glimpses of Ray's writing studio once in a while when the door would be cracked. I never went in because it didn't look like somewhere you want to go.
Oh, but, yeah. Jeff has broken my concentration number of times with clattering his paint cans up the stairs.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was kind of an accidental friendship and getting to know each other through a couple of odd directions, you know?
Nice. In terms of songwriting, what sorts of things are you trying to accomplish? And say you're sitting down to write a song, what are your biggest challenges in that process?
I think I've never been concerned with what a song is about. You get that as a question, you know, what's that song about, you know? But I just was such a fan of songs growing up, you know, songs on the radio. When we were growing up, great songs were on the radio. You know, it was everything from Al Green to Badfinger to Sly Stone and the Rolling Stones and David Bowie. So you had everything. I just love songs, and I love the way they made me feel. You know, I didn't necessarily have to even know what they were about, you know, although I did love lyrics, and that's part of what makes you feel something. But
how they made you feel. You were one of the first people who actually said it that simply, but that's what it is, right?
I mean, it's very simple. I mean, it's just like art. It's like looking at a painting on the wall. You either like it or you don't, and it does something to you, you don't. And you can be educated about art, and you can know where the artist lived and about the brush strokes and the paints from that. But, you know, it really doesn't matter. It either works or it doesn't. And songs work or they don't. And to me, I just, you know, there are certain songs that I grew up hearing on the radio that I loved, that I remember exactly how they made me feel then. And not just psychologically, but just, you know, you remember the weather and the smell and the texture of things, you know, or what the front porch looked like or what the car was like that you heard it in, you know. And
isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
The detail.
That it's such a imprint on you. And,
yeah.
So I think when I try to write songs, that's all I'm shooting for, is just like maybe I can make something that feels almost as good as Waterloo Sunset.
And we talked about this last time you were here, Ray. You're setting off on this journey, and a lot of times you don't know where it's going to go, but it inevitably somewhere in that short story creation, it just kind of comes to you.
And listening to Jeff just now talk about songs, there is exactly the same motivation in creating a short story. I'm trying to evoke an emotional response in my readers. I realize that it's not always going to be the same emotional response that I get from writing the story.
Isn't that important to you?
That's not important. There are not real specific messages, I think, in most of my stories anyway. I'm just telling a story. And I want the story to be able to connect with the reader in some way and evoke an emotional response, just like with the song, how that song hits you. When you listen to that song, and you're like, that makes me feel good. Or, boy, that makes me miss that one special person. Or, you know how that hits you.
Sure.
And that's the same thing with the story.
When I speak to visual artists, a lot of times, they're working through a gesture or a use of light or an angle or something over months, years, sometimes maybe an entire career. Are there moments in your writing that recur or images or things?
Oh, absolutely.
What sorts of things?
A lot of times, I think, for me, if people read enough of my short stories, they're going to see patterns, more behavioral patterns, I think, in the characters rather than physical characteristics. Most of my stories do take place in North Carolina, so setting does echo throughout a lot of my stories, but it's more the emotional angst that my characters are going through and how they respond, I think, that is probably the more common thread that people will find in my stories.
Jeffrey, in terms of this idea of recurring material, I mean, isn't that kind of the challenge of every composer to try, I want to break away. I've had even friends who are composers that stuck pencils between their fingers so they
so
could
they
do something funny to
the keyboard. Force them to play differently.
Exactly.
I don't worry about that. I don't think that much about that kind of stuff. You know, sometimes I do have to, I think it's best to somehow get out of your head, you know, and that's hard to do. I've had producers in the studio know that was like my problem and probably a lot of people's problems when you're singing. We were in Memphis recording one time, and this old producer, Jim Dickinson, who's kind of a legend redneck artist, between songs, I was singing, just kind of haphazardly singing something like I think I was singing Bob Dylan's Hurricane, like a couple verses of that. And he pushed the talk back, and he said, "No, that's some singing. Sing like that, you know, instead of like, you know, what I was doing." But it was still me. It was just that I was detached from my precious little songs. You know, and I was singing,
yeah.
I was just singing a song. And I did learn a lot from that. Not that I got it right then, but I always remember that. And so now I try to sing vocals in the studio when I'm least thinking about it. You know, we'll mix a song and get it almost done. And then I'll say, well, I'm going to run out there and sing it real quick. You know, and I don't, you know, some people do the opposite. Some people like dress up for vocals that week. You know, they're doing vocals that week. And so they come dressed, you know, or they're, because it's a serious thing, you know. But for me, I have to like catch myself without realizing I'm doing anything important, just kind of accidentally stumble on it. And yeah, trying to short circuit your brain a little bit.
That ties in with this whole concept of getting out of your way.
Yeah.
To let it happen.
That's the hardest thing, I think, is because, you know, if you're smart enough to write a song, you're also smart enough to like confuse yourself too and think too much about it. So it is a matter of getting out of the way. Even though it's an odd idea, we were talking last night, like if either one of us had ever heard of this kind of thing being done, I'm sure it's not, doesn't seem that novel, you know, it's just like, because to me, rock and roll and writing, especially the kind of stories that Ray writes, are kind of similar. you know, there's not a whole lot different from some of Ray's stories to some of the, you know, Bruce Springsteen songs on Nebraska or something. You know, they're very similar, but I don't know of it, this kind of thing being done very much. So it is an interesting idea. Yeah. I'll see if it works.
And we do the same thing, Jeff and I. He tells stories and I tell stories. He tries to get people to feel something and I try to get people to feel something. And it's great. So yeah. We'd like to see if we can do it together.
So we get a chance to hear short stories from the new book. And will you be performing any of the songs from your upcoming album?
Yeah, several of them will be songs that will be on the new record, which we're mixing now. We've mixed several of them now, and in the next few weeks and months, we'll hopefully get it done. So, that, yeah, I'll be playing some new songs and songs from my older records, the Pine Tops record, the Million Star Hotel record. You know, Ray had heard both of those records enough to know some of the songs and know that some of them would work. And so, yeah.
When we were working on putting this thing together last night, we were working on it. It's eerie how so many of his songs match what my stories are about.
Give me an example.
Some of my songs, maybe some of the better ones, have a tangible place and time feel or something. And a lot of time travel, too. A lot of my songs kind of don't hesitate to jump from one place to the other.
We deal, to a certain degree, with universal themes anyway. Lost love, longing, hope.
Dogs.
Getting killed.
You know. Guns. There are lots of dogs and guns and cars.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Did I grow up a Bruce Springsteen fan?
That's right. Young tigers have no
fear. My thanks to award-winning author Ray Morrison and his good friend, singer-songwriter Jeffrey Dean Foster. Two great storytellers, one great evening, is tonight, February 22nd at 7:30 at the Community Arts Cafe in downtown Winston-Salem. Hear Ray read from his wonderful collection of short stories, In a World of Small Truths, published by Press 53, and Jeffrey will perform selections from his upcoming album, as well as some old favorites from the highly acclaimed Million Star Hotel album, The Pine Tops, and more. Tickets are just $10. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org, and just click on Triad Arts Weekend. Doors open at 6:30 if you'd like to enjoy a good meal prior to the concert. There's beer and wine, and you can chat with the dynamic storytelling duo after the show. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Coming up later in the program, Martha Bassett and the Carolina Chamber Symphony Players Jazz Trio will serenade us, Gershwin style, live in Studio A. But next up, it's all Shakespeare, all the time. Twelfth Night, also known as What You Will, is a comedy by William Shakespeare. It was probably written around 1600 as a little Twelfth Night's entertainment for the close of the Christmas season. The first recorded performance was in February of 1602, and it's been slaying audiences ever since. Greensboro College's theater program brings this timeless comedy to the Gale Brower Huggins Performance Center on campus through February 24th, with evening performances at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2. Greensboro College theater faculty Josephine Hall worked as a professional actor for more than 20 years before joining the faculty there in 2011. She stopped by along with student actors Daniel Moore, who plays Duke Orsino, and Casey Garner, who plays Viola.
Make no compare between that love a woman can bear me, and that I, O Olivia.
Aye, but I know.
What dost thou know?
Too well what love women to men may owe. In faith, they are as true of heart as we. My father had a daughter, loved a man, as it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should your lordship.
And what's her history?
A blank, my lord. She never told her love, but let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined and thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love indeed? We men may say more, swear more, but indeed our shows are more than will. For still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love.
But died thy sister of her love, my boy?
I am all the daughters of my father's house, and all the brothers too. And yet I know not. Sir, shall I to this lady?
Aye, that's the theme. To her in haste, give her this jewel. Say, my love can give no place. Bide no denay.
So Olivia wants nothing to do with the Duke, but the Duke is so insistent on getting the love of Olivia. So this is the second time the Duke is trying to get Cesario to go tell Olivia that he loves her, and she's like, she's not going to love you. And he's like, you have to tell her. And that's pretty much what's going on.
Have either of you had experience in Shakespearean acting in the past?
Not with Joe Hall.
Yeah, It's not the same. I've done one show before. I did Romeo and Juliet once, and I was the friar, and it was rough. I didn't know how to do Shakespeare back then. Yeah. That's for sure.
What was the challenge then, and how's it morphed? What's the challenge now, years later?
I find the mathematics of Shakespeare are hard.
Mathematics
there's
of
like
Shakespeare.
Mathematics there's, because yeah. there's like iambic pentameter, and there's a certain amount of
there's
syllables,
so many rules.
And then there's prose, and there's verse, and sometimes you have 11 beats, and sometimes you just have to feel it out for yourself. Sometimes I'll say like a whole line and then my next line. But if there's only half of my line and Daniel has to come in, I'll say like half of it and he has to be like right there to finish it so that we keep the rhythm of it.
Now, that's interesting because some say that the fact that it is an iambic pentameter, you can memorize the lines a little bit easier. There's a flow there.
It is. It's helpful once you get the rhythm and then you get the breaths at the right spot and you know where your commas are. It's like, right there. But until you get it,
it is, yeah.
It's not coming out.
But the thing is once you learn it, slightly wrong. You have one word, you know, does to a doth.
Or it's, tis to a is.
It's the whole thing is, it doesn't feel right coming out of your mouth.
You can feel it when it's wrong too, though. But then that kind of gets me too, because then I'll like feel it wrong and I'm like, I'm saying this wrong. And then just, it's all done.
So, it's out of the bag.
It's out.
Great. Tell me about your character.
The Count Orsino is in love with the Lady Olivia, who is sort of another well-to-do, high-status person in the land. She's in mourning because her brother has just died. She lost her father before that. And so she's in this withdrawn state where she doesn't want to accept the love that Orsino has to give. And he has a lot to give, and very aggressively.
He's got a lot of love to give. I love that.
He's really persistent about letting her know how he feels.
Viola, you're taking it all in, and... Well, from Viola's view, what's going on? And you're a clever young lady.
I start to fall for him, and I love the fact that he loves all this love. He always has these love songs played, and he's always fawning over Olivia, and he's just so ridiculous, but she loves it. She loves watching him be in love. There's actually a scene where he makes Festi, the jester, play this love song, and she just watches him, and then... crazy stuff happens.
Yeah, well, the way you all are talking about this, it kind of answers the question out there, you know, why is Shakespeare valid today, you know, in the 21st century? But, I mean, we're talking about it as if it's just something that happened at school yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really is. The language is beautiful, but they're just people. You know, the characters are people who want something, and they do what they can to get it.
What I'm getting in broad strokes here, Joe, and credit to you and the program, just a lot of enthusiasm for this play, and wondering from your years of performance, what you hope to impart that may be beyond theater.
Well, for me, Shakespeare really is the key to any kind of language-based medium, and it stretches you in ways. I mean, Shakespeare used to make words up all the time, which is fantastic, and a lot of those words we don't use in everyday life now. So it really keeps our students on their toes to really break it down and figure out what are you actually doing with these words. They're using the words as tools. So it's not just, oh, I'm saying a few words just to say a meaning. No, I'm actually using my words as weapons to get what I want. And the great thing with Shakespeare is these characters are so fun. I mean, they're all so memorable in so many different ways. And what people don't realize is Shakespeare is funny. You know, but people go, oh, Shakespeare, it must be serious. You know, and I'm like, no. Well, if you think it's about sex, it's about sex, you know.
He had to pack the halls as well.
Absolutely.
And wanted an audience. It seems like this play, he does such a masterful job of presenting little idiosyncratic things in each character in a way that we can all laugh at. We all know someone like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's such a wide variety of characters in the play. That's one of the things I loved about it. It's not reliant on one, it's not a Hamlet. You know, it's not reliant on one character. Every character in this show is memorable, and they're very distinctive.
I'm wondering, for the non-actor, and someone with no Shakespeare background, whether you could give us an example of how an emphasis can heighten change.
Oh, I see. It's about making it clear for the audience. You have to keep going back to the language. That's why Shakespeare is so useful. He gives you the emphasis in the rhythm of the speeches. Mm. And it actually makes it a lot easier than something that's not in verse.
Because I've been in performances before where the lines have been uttered what I would consider slowly, where it should be more intelligible. But in fact, when I've heard it faster and more conversational, I've understood more.
Well, it's because there's certain, you know, you hit what we call operative words, and my kids are going to laugh because I'm always on about it. But it's those key points in the sentences that really show you that they're the sort of directional signs. There's a lot of words that make sense when they're strung together, but they're not that important. You could almost just take out the one, two, or three words to summarize that sentence, and you kind of get an idea of where you're going. And I think what people do is they get so bogged down, oh, I must make every single word very clear, and because I'm making every single word clear, you lose the flow of it, you know what I mean?
That's exactly what I'm getting at, yeah.
And a lot of that is the actors have to be really listening to each other, so they pick up on the energy of each other, so they fight for what they want. And it goes back to using the words as tools.
Give me an example. Could this be a sentence?
One of Viola's most famous speeches is, I left no ring with her. What means this lady? You know, I left no ring with her. What means this lady? You know, if I don't choose what words, it becomes a bit flattened.
I left no ring with her.
What means this lady? Fortune forbid my outside hath not charmed her. She made good view of me. You know, and it goes on like that. And just so you choose those things that pop out. That's what I would want the audience to know is they might not understand every single word, but because the actors have done their homework, they know what every single word means. And so the audience gets those key moments. And so what they do understand is the relationship and the petty jealousies and the arguments and the humanizing of everything. Yeah. And that's what ultimately we're going for.
Greensboro College theater faculty Josephine Hall. She was joined by student actors Daniel Moore, who plays Duke Orsino, and Casey Garner, who plays Viola. William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night is up and running at the Gail Brower Huggins Performance Center on the Greensboro College campus. You'll find links to more by going to our website, wfdd.org, and clicking on Triad Arts Weekend. The Bard's hilarious comedy will run through the 24th with evening performances at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time for a short break. Don't go away, because we've got lots of great music coming your way, from Bach to Beethoven and Schumann to swing. Renowned keyboardist and scholar Andrew Willis is here to tickle the forte piano ivories. And if you don't know what a forte piano is, fear not, because you're about to become an expert. Just think of the water cooler moments you'll share with friends at work next week. And Martha Bassett and her jazz trio will sing George and Ira Gershwin for us live in Studio A when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're off on a little time travel this half of the show with the king of the concert stage. That'd be the piano. We'll dive into the raw pianistic romanticism of pianist-composer Robert Schumann and head straight into the early 20th century with pianist-composer George Gershwin. But before that, we've got to pay tribute to the instrument that first picked up the baton from the harpsichord before evolving into the modern-day piano we know today. You could think of it as piano 1.0, the forte piano. St. Paul's organist and choir master John Cummins began the Friends of Music series at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, determined to have a core of early music with historic instruments, vocal music practice, and fully utilizing the historic Gothic building at St. Paul's. Thanks to the Peggy Norfleet Memorial Fund, he's been able to continue the Friends of Music series and to expand its emphasis, including a wide variety of musical styles. Friends of Music is sponsoring three concerts so far in 2013. The first is keyboard master Andrew Willis from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He'll be giving a recital on one of his fantastic forte pianos on Sunday night, March 3rd at 7:30. John stopped by for a season preview, but first, Andrew spoke with me by phone from his studio in Greensboro about the magic of the precursor to the modern piano, the forte piano, or loud soft. What are some of the things on the piano forte that are, say, easier to do than on a modern Busendorf or Steinway or something?
Well, I'd say that in many ways, all of the instruments of that earlier period have certain things in common, which are that they are highly resonant, so you get a great deal of immediate response from the instrument. This makes it possible to produce sound without exerting one's strength. In fact, the adjustment one has to make is in the opposite direction, to learn how to apply just the right amount of energy so that one doesn't overplay the instrument. And once you've done that, it provides just an enormous amount of nuance and flexibility of the sound. And one of the things I would say that is advantageous about the forte piano is that the sound develops instantly. You get it all up front, and then it dies away quickly. And you might think that doesn't sound like such a good thing in a piano. It starts strong and then it disappears. But many of the gestures of that classical style involve figures such as the psi figure, which exactly does that. It lives into the beginning of a set of notes and then releases with a lighter sound as you go along. And this instrument is extremely well suited to that. It's also very articulate, because the dampers are efficient and quick, and so you can control the end of the note just as precisely as you control the beginning of the note.
Listening to your recordings that you submitted, I felt like I was hearing these pieces as if I somehow was closer to the composer.
In many ways, these instruments really do sort of open a window into a sound world that was very close to what the composers lived with. And Beethoven or Haydn, or going back even further to the sons of Bach, these gentlemen all composed for the instruments that they knew, and they were absolutely excited over the forte piano, largely, of course, because it was something new in the world and did not have the dynamic limitations of the harpsichord, in which the actual loudness of the plucked sound does not change from one note to the next. But in addition, the style of that period was a very articulate style. Perhaps it's an oversimplification, but in the 19th century, the ideal for keyboard music became to sing, and an instrument which had the longest sustaining tone was thought to be the best because it could come closest to imitate the human voice. The 18th century understood singing very well, but they were more interested in their instrumental music, in what you could call a speaking style, where the free flow of ideas, almost in a sort of a conversational way, was very much a part of the thinking, whether it was in a Haydn string quartet or a Beethoven symphony or a Mozart keyboard sonata. These were elements of the style that are very well served by these instruments.
Now, I imagine at the time that Beethoven sat down to compose the variations on the original theme, that somewhat of the novelty of the pianoforte had worn off. How did the public respond to that form, the use of variation at that time? I mean, in the wake of sonata form and, you know,
yes,
other sophisticated
forms? I would love to. In fact, now, as to the variations, variations are a wonderful form of entertainment music, because there's a tradition associated with variations that they would customarily be improvised for the audience. Someone would perhaps call out a tune, and the performer would then, assuming they knew the tune, would go through it and change the tempo, change the accompaniment figure, change the rhythm, try and come up with different ways of treating that idea. And it was considered to be a sort of a form of entertainment. Occasionally, composers would write down a composed set of variations, and we have several from Haydn, several from Mozart, and a good many from Beethoven. But I have a feeling that that's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of variations that they actually sat down and made up on the spot.
This lineage, I think you fleshed out nicely, I guess, in this program, with an emphasis on a man at the center of it all, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. Talk about his connection with this period in music and his influence on names we would be even more familiar with.
Well, I'm very happy to talk about Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. He's about to enjoy some concerted attention coming up in the year 2014 when he'll be turning 300 and there will be Immanuel Bach events all over the world. Immanuel Bach was neither the oldest nor the youngest son of his father, Sebastian, but in many ways he was the most famous during his lifetime. The first half of his career, he was in the employ of the King of Prussia, Frederick the Great. And after leaving Berlin, he became the director of music for the churches in Hamburg in northern Germany, similar to the job that his father had held in Leipzig. So he really got to know the European musical scene from many different perspectives. He knew how to write in the French style, the Italian style, but one thing that he did not try to do was to write fugues in the style of his father. That was considered old hat and very much behind the times. However, one of his great influences took place in the form of a manual for how to play keyboard instruments. It's still a resource that we turn to regularly today for information on style and on understanding how keyboard playing was thought of in the middle of the 18th century. This was published widely, spread across Europe. I'm absolutely certain that it was known and read by Haydn, by Mozart, and by Beethoven, all of whom acknowledged a debt to Immanuel Bach. They said, "He's the father, we are the children," and such other kinds of praise.
I've heard that before, but I never spoken to a keyboard player who's looked through the work to tell me, what was it about that monumental work that influenced them? What, was it specifically a technique thing or a phrasing idea?
Well, of course, as composers, they would also have been influenced by the study of his compositions. But as keyboard players, what we find today is useful are information on fingering. It includes a thorough treatment of the art of accompaniment, wonderful section on improvisation, in which, by the way, he has some very flattering things to say about the forte piano, which was quite new then. And it also just covers a world of basics in terms of what was considered to be the essence of good performance. I think perhaps my favorite quote from Immanuel Bach's book is when he asks the performer to play from the heart and not like a trained bird. If that sounds like a very romantic concept, it indeed was. His idea of performance was very much the expression of feeling.
That is something that is so valid today. How many performances have we all heard where all the notes were in their proper place, but it was a completely unmoving performance?
It's been known to happen.
In April, we'll have two guys called Organized Rhythm. Hmm. Yeah, Joe Gramley and Clive Driscoll Smith. Joe is at the University of Michigan now teaching in the percussion department, and Clive is English. And so they come together through Philip Truckenbrod Artist Management, and Joe fills the chancel of the church full of all kinds of percussion instruments, and Clive accompanies him on the organ, and it's a whole lot of symphonic transcriptions and things, and he runs all over the front of the church in this acrobatic kind of display of it's visually and orally entertaining. And then finally, we'll present British organist David Briggs, who is going to do things like accompany a silent film and things like that. So it'll make good use of the romantic and orchestral tones of the Skinner organ and then play some good solid repertoire for the organ too.
That was St. Paul's choir master and organist John Cummins. The first performance of the Friends of Music series at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem is keyboard master Andrew Willis from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He'll be giving a recital on one of his amazing forte pianos on Sunday night, March 3rd at 7:30, with music by Beethoven, Haydn, C.P.E. Bach, and more. All the music composed between 1773 and 1803. You'll find links to more information and photos at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and it's time for a quick break before we hike across the Beethoven Bridge from the classical era into the Romantic period with our guide Peter Karoff at the keyboard. He's got his ears trained on Robert Schumann. Then stick around for some great Gershwin performances live in Studio A with singer Martha Bassett, bassist Matt Kendrick, and pianist Federico Pivetta next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard.
is the beginning of a charming set of pieces called Scenes of Childhood by Robert Schumann. They were composed in 1838 when Schumann was about 28 years old himself and kind of looking back on childhood. And this set of pieces, 13 of them, sort of paint different pictures, different aspects of either memories of his own childhood or of sort of idealized childhood in general. They're good examples of romantic miniatures known as character pieces. A character piece is just a short piece, a minute or two in length, which, as you can tell from the name, draws a particular mood or character and just sticks with it for the whole piece. The piece I was just playing has a funny title. It's called Of Foreign Lands and People. The image I think he's trying to portray is of a young boy, perhaps on his rocking horse, dreaming that someday he's going to travel and go far away. You have this nice melody on top, which falls back each time. A nice counter melody down here. And then these triplets that are handed between the hands that add up to this. It's those triplets that make me think of the rocking horse. Another piece has a funny title called Important Event. And this might be a picture of a young boy pretending to be the mayor of his town or of witnessing a big parade outside his window. Another charming one of this set is called Child Falling Asleep. Before I play it, let me just play the left hand for you. So it has that haunting, insistent, hypnotic quality of a lullaby, rocking back and forth. The right hand has a similar melody, but comes in a beat later, and so the two of them combine like this. Very, very poignant ending to this when it closes. That was unexpected. This chord doesn't usually resolve that way, it usually resolves this way. Instead, he resolves it. Don't you expect it to go? But instead, he leaves you hanging because the boy's fallen asleep. Probably the most famous of the 13 pieces in this set is entitled Träumerei, or Träumerei in German. I guess that translates best as Dreamery, of dreams, a portrait perhaps of a young child daydreaming. That's probably Schumann's most famous piece, and it's a good example of using very, very simple means to create a very, very moving and evocative mood. Robert Schumann, 1838, Scenes from Childhood.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. That's a little old segment we like to call Understanding Classical Music. You know, Robert Schumann was fairly well recognized in his own lifetime as composer and critic. He wrote lots of well-regarded songs, or Lieder, too, but few songwriters have enjoyed the success of Americans George and Ira Gershwin. The Carolina Winter Music Festival reminds us why this amazing duo enjoyed such enduring success with Gershwin Portraits in Rinalda House Museum of American Art this Sunday, February 24th at 2. In the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery there, it'll be a concert of selections by the Gershwins celebrating opening weekend of the new exhibit, Star Power, Edward Steichen's glamour photography, including Gershwin portraits taken by Steichen. Gershwin was the first American composer to bring jazz into the concert hall, and singer Martha Bassett and the Carolina Chamber Symphony Players Jazz Trio will perform an all-Gershwin program amidst the more than 100 spectacular photographs in the exhibition by the first great American fashion photographer. Martha recently stopped by with pianist Federico Pivetta and bassist Matt Kendrick for a sampling live in Studio A. And they kick things off with Gershwin's classic, They Can't Take That Away From Me.
The way you change my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me.
Can't Take That Away From Me. We heard live in Studio A, that was Miss Martha Bassett singing there, Freddie Pivetta on piano, and Matt Kendrick on bass. And this is what we call a standard. It's played all the time. Everyone loves it. How many times have you played this tune?
You know, hundreds. I don't know.
But I mean, what's it like playing a tune like that after you've done it hundreds of times and keeping it fresh? And what do you think when you're playing it?
Well, I'm just trying to make the changes, you know, and it's a lifelong pursuit to do different things with the changes. And so that's what keeps this music interesting to me.
When you say the changes, well, for the non-musician, what are you talking about?
Talking about the chord changes in the song. There's a certain, you know, the harmonic progression, so to speak.
Listening to the bass line, a walking bass line like that, what are you thinking about? I mean, just could you translate what's going on up there? I mean, I see a D minus 7 flat 5. I see a D flat 7 C with a negative 7 B 7. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, oh, yeah. I want a theory 101 in 30 seconds.
I'm going like D, D, G, G, D. No.
There's more to it than that, isn't there, Matt?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. There's all kinds of different ways to the top of the mountain and different perspectives to take when you're walking a bass line, different ways to go about it. And, you know, and sometimes I might take a thing where I'm coming down through the changes, or I might play the change as it is, or, you know, there's just a lot of different variables, and I try to hear what's going on and try to play something that makes, you know, Martha sound good and Fred sound good and support what's going on and make it feel good swing.
You're going to hear Matt, all he's got in front of him is the melody sketched out. Let's hear what it sounds like walking. I love it. No need to wonder why they call it a walking bass. It's just like a walk through the park. Another thing I love about, well, all of Gershwin's music is, yeah, it was written back in the early 1900s, and yet it's just so fresh. As the singer telling this tale, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is getting the text across in a way that will resonate with the audience, but also making it swing. Really, the phrasing to me, is what I'm thinking about the most.
You were swinging hard in here, you three. For the non-jazzer, what do you mean when you say you got to make it swing? I don't see any swings in here.
Well, I'm not going to sing. The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, it's na-na-na-na-na. You kind of got to lean into the beat, and where you put the beat makes all the difference as to how it swings.
I love that difference. And your background is in classical singing and choral singing, so you're well adept at both. Ham it up for me a little bit. Give me just a line like that in Western classical music tradition and then contrast it with swinging it.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea.
And now we're going to swing it.
The way you wear your hat.
Oh, you don't need to say any more than that. All right. Within five notes, she's in the pocket. All right. Hey, you know, I know you played this tune 100 times too, Freddie, but you always play it as if it's for the first time, but you know it sounds great. This tune, or any Gershwin tune, as a pianist, your thoughts on the man and his music?
I think, first of all, the tunes are just fantastic. They're just so beautifully written. I don't think there is a Gershwin song that I've heard that I don't like. What makes this interesting is every time, depending on the configuration of instruments that we have, you know, we have to treat the tune in a slightly different way, but still at the same time convey the message of the song. And we were talking earlier about, you know, I guess we can call it a swing factor on this. It's really amazing that if you're asking me about what to tell to somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience listening to jazz. When you are able to portray an energy that goes out of the song just by really swinging it, a person will definitely will feel that internally, that I mean, a really good driving rhythm makes everybody starts to snap. So there's a natural energy that just happens when you play this kind of music.
Yeah, it's there right away. I was in there dancing listening to you all play that one.
Yeah, I think it was Wynton Marsalis that was talking about swing. He says, well, it's hard to say exactly what it is, but once you get some, you're going to want to come back for some more.
I believe that. Well, speaking of that, here live in Studio A, and we're looking at a beautiful upright bass. We've got Freddie was kind enough to bring in his electric keyboard here, and Martha's on the microphone. I want to hear more. What's next on our little live in Studio A program, Martha?
How long has this been going on?
All Gershwin today. George and his brother Ira chimed in on this one as well. So Ira Gershwin lyrics and George Gershwin the music. This is How Long Has This Been Going On?
Stars at bazaars, often I've had to caress men. $5 or $10 then I'd collect from all those yes men. Don't be sad, I must add that they meant no more than chess men. Darling, can't you see? 'Twas for charity. Though these lips have made slips, it was never really serious. Who'd have thought I'd be brought to a state that's so delirious. I could cry salty tears. Where have I been all these years? Little tell me now, how long has this been going on? There were chills up my spine and some thrills I can't define. Listen, sweet, I repeat, how long has this been going? to heaven, I'm hurt. I know how Columbus felt, finding another world. Kiss me once, then once more. What a break, for heaven's sake. How long has this been going on?
All right. Martha Bassett singing for us, Matt Kendrick on bass, and Federico Pivetta on the keyboards. How long has this been going on? What was that? The line, I know how Columbus felt discovering a new world. Man, they don't write them like that anymore. That's for sure. And what was that line about kiss me twice, thrice? And
kiss me twice, then once more. That makes thrice. Let's make it four.
Oh, man, I think I hear lines like that. You know, I'm in there giggling. I'm thinking I must have been born in the wrong era. Boy, you tell that story great, Martha. And that's slow. Talk about singing a slow ballad like that.
Well, it's my favorite thing to do. I would sing nothing but ballads if I could get away with it.
It presents challenges, too, at the same time, doesn't it?
I kind of keep a subdivision going on and try and play around that idea.
Talk about subdivision. That concept, I think, is really cool.
Well, if the regular meter is 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and I could cry, I'm feeling da 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 da. So it gives you different places to accent within the phrase, so you don't have to stay right on the stronger beats. You can move the strong beats around to different spots within the phrase. It still works if you do it that way, if you kind of keep the smaller increments in mind.
Matt, this whole performance coincides with goings-on at Rinalda House. I love the idea, the concept of pairing this great music with photography. What's the occasion?
Well, they're having an exhibit, or the exhibition at the Rinalda House of Edward Steich. He was a great glamour photographer in the 30s and the 40s, and he was a museum curator. He did a lot of stuff. Whole lot of stuff, but his pictures are great. He did, you know, Gershwin, has pictures of Gershwin, which are going to be in his show, hence the concert. Hopefully we can have some of them projected while we're playing. If not, then you can listen to the tune and go look at them. But there's one in particular that made me think of They Can't Take That Away From Me, is a picture of Gershwin at a piano with a cigar in his mouth writing on some music, and it's like, it has this look on his face. It looks like, yeah, they can't take that away from me.
Because Gershwin was, I mean, he was, photos taken of the guy because he was kind of a superstar in his own day.
Oh, yeah, he was a big rock star. American in Paris, all these shows he wrote, you know, tons of shows. He was a big star. Great. His tunes were so great that they've lasted all these years, and the jazz musicians took them and adapted them to their vernacular. And one in particular was I Got Rhythm, which is like rhythm changes, which are like as ubiquitous as the blues or anything else. They're like a standard form the world over. And that was his tune and his form and stuff.
You want to scat a few bars?
I got rhythm. I got music.
That's all it takes. That's amazing. When you can sing two bars and everyone knows the tune, you've done something. What can we leave our listeners with? A Gershwin classic.
Well, this is one of Martha's favorites, I believe, right? Yeah, it's called Someone to Watch Over Me.
There's a saying old, says that love is blind. So we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm gonna seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's the big affair I cannot forget. to add his initial to my monogram.
Pianist Federico Pivetta, singer Martha Bassett, and bassist Matt Kendrick will team up with drummer John Wilson for Gershwin Portraits in Rinola House Museum of American Art this Sunday, February 22nd at 2, in the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery. Martha and the Carolina Chamber Symphony Players Jazz Trio are celebrating the opening weekend of the new Rinola House exhibit, Star Power, Edward Steichen's Glamour Photography, including some fantastic Gershwin portraits taken by America's first great fashion photographer. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Steichen biographer and Triad native Penny Niven will have a conversation with Steichen's granddaughter at 3 o'clock, immediately following the performance, and ticket admission covers it all. It's $18, $8 for Rinola House members and students, and that includes admission to Rinola House as well. It's a full day of American art, history, and music. Well, that's all for today's program. Our producer and recording engineer is Eddie Garcia, associate producer Bethany Chafin, and you'll find podcasts and archive shows at wfdd.org/triadarts. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the art scene in the Triad, questions, comments, and suggestions. You'll find us on Facebook, and you can drop us an email. The address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.